The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. Good evening. And what a day. What a day. I don't know if you can see it, but I am wearing my patriotic tie because I think it's a great day to be an American. I came here by train, and when I got to Union Station at 4 o'clock to catch the train, I had, you know, the papers at home this morning, but I wanted to get a fresh batch of them, and there were no papers. And the porter said that he had gotten to the station at 6:30 a.m., and they were gone by then. And I think that's a very good sign for America. So anyway, well done, America. I have some sympathy for presidential candidates because tonight, this event, is the last event of a book tour of mine that began the day that Senator McCain selected Governor Palin, which seems a very long time ago. My clothing allowance for the tour was slightly less than hers, but I was able to afford this tie. I think this is a wonderful way to end my tour, and I just had a terrific dinner within a spitting distance, if that's quite the right word, of the actual raven that was the inspiration for Edgar Allan Poe, a raven that was a pet of Charles Dickens and is stuffed in a glass case. It's a very strange place you've got here, you know. You really know how to set a person at ease. Here's a stuffed raven from the 1870s. Whoa, how weird is that? But anyway, this is an utterly splendid venue to end a book tour, and I'm kind of glad it's over. Book tours are funny things. I was some weeks ago. I did it's called a satellite TV tour, and what they do is they lock you in a room with a robotic camera, so that you feel as though you're some rare virus that is being studied. And you have an earpiece and a technician in another room. I did 18 consecutive live television interviews with various markets across the country. And at the end of each one, the technician would say, next one is Mike in Minneapolis. So, you would hear this, Mr. Buckley? And I'd say, yes. And thinking to keep things light, I said to Mike in Minneapolis, this was not long after the Republican convention, I said, well, did you get rid of all those Republicans? And there was this sort of awkward pause, and he said, well, we've still got a few left. I said, oh. I said, well, how's my friend Al Franken doing? And there was another awkward pause, and he said, well, I don't know, really. I thought, well, this is strange. I'm trying to get some repartee going, and, well, the thing is, it wasn't Mike in Minneapolis. It was Kevin in Tulsa. So I could hear the sound of 10,000 remote controls in Tulsa going, let's see if there's something else on. You do get a little bit punchy during these things. After my seventh or eighth or so book, I got sort of bored with those about the author paragraphs on the book flap. Those are the paragraph that authors pretend they didn't write. You know, the ones that begin, he considered one of the leading voices of his generation. So I just started to make them up. And this is a book called Little Green Man. And I wrote, he has been an advisor to every American president since William Howard Taft. Why not? Yeah. So I found myself about 2 weeks into that book tour walking into an AM drive time talk radio station. There is a hierarchy. And up here you have, you know, All Things Considered and your own Terry Gross, you know. Down about here you have the drive time AM talk shows. So I walked into the studio, and there the host, to use a somewhat, I think, grandiose term for what he what he does, was speed reading the one paragraph about the author with a sort of a beetling brow. And he looked up, and I knew right away that this was all he would know about me, and certainly all he would know about the book. And he looked up at me as I walked in and said, you were an advisor to William Howard Taft? And I said, yeah. His brow beetled a little further. And he said, well, so we could talk about that? And I said, yeah. And we did. I have not been asked back on that radio show. But, boy, it was worth it. So tonight I thought I would share some of my reminiscences of the Taft presidency with you. But knowing this to be a very literate audience, perhaps I shouldn't go there. Supreme Courtship. This is my 13th book. I have written, I write comic books. Well, maybe that's, I write comic novels. Sounds a bit better, right? About Washington institutions. I've written about the White House and the State Department, the FBI, the CIA, NASA. I'm sort of running out of Washington institutions. I'll pretty soon be having to write about the Interior Department. Although, who knows, you know, I'm sure there's literature wherever you look for it, generally. But I thought to give the Supreme Court a try. You know, this is, as Washington institutions go, a Himalaya. You know, this is, it is not, however, inherently a laugh riot. In the book, someone describes the Supreme Court as nine old farts in black robes who sending footnotes to each other. It is every now and then the Supreme Court provides humor, I suppose, as when it decides our presidential elections. That was funny. and I'm very glad that they didn't have to decide this one. I think that would be about the last thing that we needed. Harry Truman, some of you, I think, are perhaps old enough to remember the name, famously had a sign on his desk at the White House, and it said, "The buck stops here." Well, these days, the buck sort of merely pauses on the presidential desk, generally on its way up to the Supreme Court. So it would... I always thought that that would make an appropriate motto on the marble frieze that above the pillars, the stone, the marble pillars of the court. You know, the buck stops here. Actually, the words inscribed there are equal justice under law. Some of you, I'm sure, already knew that. I have long wanted to redo the mottos on Washington official buildings. I just think they could, some of them could use a little freshening up. You know, it's for instance, the National Archives. Anyone know what's carved over the front door of the National Archives? It's a quote from Shakespeare. "The past is prologue." Well, okay, but you know, I think we could do better than that, frankly. How about you could Google it? Yeah. Wouldn't that look good? Yeah. You could go. In, you know, that Latin sort of, even do the U could be a V, you know? That look good, right? The Justice Department. I'll give $10 to anyone who can tell me what's carved over the door of the Justice Department. And I know that we have at least one distinguished jurist here. But the Honorable Wendy Pugh doesn't even know. Well, it's, I'll tell you what it is. It's here it is. I found it. "Justice is founded in the rights bestowed by nature upon man." Oh, come on. It's probably from, you know, Socrates or something. But I think I would propose replacing it with a single word: freeze. Or maybe step away from the vehicle. The Pentagon. Now there's a bill. There is nothing inscribed over the door of the Pentagon, and I think this is a terrible waste of space. I mean, quite literally. I mean, here is a building that surely cries out for a kick-ass inscription. I would propose, "Make my day." Or, "Nation building since 2003. All right. We weren't going to do that, were we? No. Anyway, it's, you know, it's very, so the Supreme Court, it's very imposing, you know, the Supreme Court. I'm sure some of you have stood in front of it, and I'm sure some of you have been inside it, and some of you have probably even argued cases. Those of you who have been inside the Supreme Court will perhaps remember what an august feeling it imparts. This is, it's a working Greek temple. There aren't many of those left, thank God. But you almost expect someone to walk by with a white ox, you know, who's on the way to the altar. But it is a very august place. It's the sort of place where you don't pick your nose because you feel that Zeus is sort of up there watching and ready to hurl a thunderbolt. When the building was built in 1934, I think it was. It was considered by some of the justices to be, you know, a bit over the top. And one of them famously said, "Now we're going to look like 9 black beetles in the Temple of Karnak." So whenever I see the group portrait of the 9 justices, I think they're the 9 black beetles in the Temple of Karnak. So I thought, okay, well, let's give the Supreme Court a go. Let's have some fun with the Supreme Court. But the trick was sort of trying to find my way in. I generally go in the back door, as indeed I did tonight. I was one of these days I hope to go through the front door of the Philadelphia Free Library, a free man. Instead, they said, no, take the service entrance. Most novels about the Supreme Court these days tend to begin with the Chief Justice being assassinated by the pharmaceutical industry, you know, because they have learned from the corrupt clerk that he is going to vote against renewing the patent for the restless leg syndrome drug. And then the heroine, who is a very dishy female clerk, not corrupt, for another justice, falls in league with the handsome and buff investigator for the shadowy U.S. agency that monitors the purity of the restless leg syndrome drugs. And his name would inevitably be, you know, Brad. And the novel end will climax with an exciting car chase through the reflecting pool in front of the Lincoln Memorial, and then maybe actually end up at the in a glorious shootout at the FDR Memorial with bullets zinging off the statue of Fala. And remember Fala? Some of you remember. I remember Fala. But those aren't really the kind of books I write. I should. I would be a very wealthy person if I wrote such books. But I write satire. Satire, you know, writing satire in America is really kind of a pointless task. I mean, you know, you're in a losing competition with USA Today. Tom Lehrer, do you remember Tom Lehrer? That was the week where he gave up satire after Henry Kissinger won the Nobel Peace Prize. He said there was just really no point. Anyway, and I have been tempted to give up a couple of times. There's hardly any hypothetical situation I could come up with that would top American reality. You may know the story of the teenage boy who has to write a paper for school on the difference between hypothetical and reality. And so he goes into his dad's study one night and asks him if he would give him a hand with his paper. And the father thinks for a moment and says, well, go ask your mother if she would sleep with a total stranger for $1 million. So he goes off and he comes back pretty quickly and reports that the answer is, you bet. So he says, well, go ask your sister. So he goes off and he comes back sort of lickety-split and reports that the answer is, totally. He says, well, there you go. Hypothetically, we're sitting on $2 million. In reality, we're living with a couple of hookers. very, very, very tricky satire. I once wrote a piece for the New Yorker. I became obsessed with the proliferation of books about fly fishing. Did you notice that? You know, fly fishing used to be just fly fishing. You would stand in ice cold water up to your you know whats for hours on end and not catch anything. But you know, have a pleasant enough experience, go home, drink a beer, whatever. And then suddenly people began to invest fly fishing with mystical aspects, and books started coming out with titles like Fly Fishing Through the Midlife Crisis, or, Rediscovering God Through Fly Fishing. And they would have debates about whether or not, St. Paul would have been a dry fly fisherman or a nympher, So I thought, well, let's have some fun with that. There were so many of them, really. You'd go into a bookstore and it would be fiction, nonfiction, fly fishing. So I thought, well, let's have some fun with that. And I wrote one of those back page humor things that, in the form of reviews in brief of the new batch of fly fishing books. And, about a paragraph each. And one of the books was Peter Benchley's new novel, Gills, about a vengeful trout. And the exciting climax involved a squadron of Canadian Air Force F-15s and a canoe paddle. One of the books was called one of the other books was called Bass Holes. And this was an attack on a bass fisherman by a sort of prissy, vituperative, dry fly, barbless trout fisherman who said that, bass fishermen were really beneath contempt because all they cared about were women with big breasts and beer, So it came out, and then a funny thing happened. People started going to the bookstores and asking for these books. And the book they really wanted, Bass Holes, So they would go to the clerk at Barnes & Noble and say, I can't find Bass Holes. And so he would, no, we don't carry it. I said, well, what do you mean you don't carry it? It was in the New Yorker, No. So people started getting angry, and they started calling the New Yorker, and the New Yorker started referring the calls to me. So these are the pitfalls of writing satire in America. Yeah. Ultimately, the joke is on you. Anyway, how are we doing for time? The Supreme Court, but enough about that. Let's talk more about me. The Supreme Court, so I thought, well, how do I find my way in? So I was on the Acela train. I live on the Acela in the quiet car. I am the self-appointed Nazi of the quiet car. I go around shushing people. It's funny, there's signs. There are eight signs that say, please refrain from, just using the cell phone. And invariably, someone gets on and goes, Harry, okay, I'm on the quiet car now. So I go around shushing them. My life used to be more interesting. It was sex, drugs, rock and roll. And now I've become, pardon the expression, a librarian. I go around, shh. I once shushed the director of the FBI. He was on the quiet car with his, entourage. And they were all very bulgy. So it took I had to sort of screw up. But he was sitting right there going, yeah, what are we going to do about Al-Qaeda, And as interested as I was, and I didn't want to impede justice, but I sort of cautiously reached out and tapped him, and I sort of stood back, expecting a fusillade of, I said, Mr. Director, you're a great American, and I'm a great fan of the FBI, but this is the quiet car. So he went, oh. So six FBI agents got up and moved to another car. I thought, wow, yeah. This will be in the second paragraph of my obituary. Shushed director of FBI. If I get a second paragraph. So anyway, there I was on the quiet car with my legal pad. You know, I figured if I'm going to write a novel about the Supreme Court, I must use a legal pad. I bet the Honorable Wendy Pugh uses a legal pad. Do you use a legal pad at home? Yeah. Yellow? You know, the traditional. Yeah, good. Good, good, good. I'm glad to hear that. So I stared at the yellow legal. Mine was also yellow. And stared. And stared and stared. And nothing really came. And then I found myself just writing down the words, Judge Judy. I had never seen Judge Judy, but I was aware generally of her existence and the whole concept, you know, America being one large reality TV show at this point. So I thought, okay, Judge Judy on the Supreme Court. But now, how does one get Judge Judy on the Supreme Court? You see, this is the challenge of being a novelist. And kids, don't try this at home. You know, this is a very tricky business. It makes rocket science pale. So I thought, well, so I went out on a limb for a Washington novel, and I made the president a good person. You know, typically they're not good. They're cheating on the wife or taking money from Uzbekistan or, you know. But I said, so I did some research, and there have been some scientific studies that everyone from Ohio is nice. So I had him come from Ohio. No, it's a fact. I'm sure Pennsylvanians are nice, but Ohio is, well, you have the consolation of being right next to Ohio. And I'm sure they all started in Pennsylvania, and then just they got a little nicer once they crossed the border. And just for good measure, I had him come from Neil Armstrong's hometown. Can anyone name the Neil Armstrong's hometown? Good for you. Good for you. Well done, sir. Well done, sir. Wapakoneta, indeed. And so and his name is Donald. I named him Donald Vanderdamp because who could not be nice with a name like that? You could never imagine someone saying, Heil Vanderdamp, you know. So he's a good guy, just trying to do his best. And he's, you know, trying to control federal spending and all the rest. And but his arch nemesis is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who has had some Botox and some other work done. And he's run for president a few times, and he can't shut up and talks a lot, loves to talk a lot. And he keeps shooting down his nominees for the most frivolous reasons. Finally, after he does it the umpteenth time, the president, who is very even-keeled, but he's now in just a funk and a very bad mood, and he and the first golden retriever, Dwight, go off to Camp David for the weekend. The first lady is being honored for a disease in New York. Not because she has the disease, but you know, for raising awareness of the disease. And so the president and Dwight are in bed, channel surfing, and they're looking for the bowling channel because they're being in Ohio and he's deeply into bowling. And he chances on this television program called Courtroom Six, the star of which is this, an actual municipal court judge named Pepper Cartwright, who is from Texas, and she's very sexy, brunette. She wears glasses. She looks sort of like a naughty librarian. And she wears a pistol. She has a pistol permit. She wears a pistol under her robes. You know, I think men find that sexy. Women with guns. And she's very sort of, you know, sassy and witty. And this is one of the top-rated shows on television. So the president he hadn't even been aware of it. He finds himself fixated on this, and Dwight is wagging his tail. So he thinks, okay, let's see you shoot her down. So he nominates her. So, ladies and gentlemen, I give you a novel in which I handed in January, in which the protagonists are a cosmetically enhanced U.S. senator who has run for president and can't stop talking, versus a glasses-wearing, gun-toting TV hottie. I am announcing tonight my retirement from satire. As Yogi Berra said when he was told that a Jewish man had been elected mayor of Dublin, only in America. Thank you very much. Thank you. You're a very polite audience, I must say. But I expected nothing less from Philadelphia. I have been instructed by my very strict hosts to take any questions that you might have, questions about bulk purchases of the book, or constitutional law. But I would be happy to entertain. Yes, sir. As many as were absolutely necessary. I respect Joe Biden. His politics are not identical to mine, but you know he's a serious guy with a and I think you know as a satirist I have to say my endorsement, such as to use a fancy term for just coming out in favor of Mr. Obama, was problematic because, my inner satirist kind of yearned for a McCain-Palin administration. This, you know, I felt would be a target-rich environment. The motto of the practicing political satirist must perforce be country second. Much depends on Vice President Joe Biden. I will look to him to keep us amused while President Obama gets us out of this rather deep hole we seem to have dug for ourselves. Yes, to the arm that I can barely see, but I see an arm. Hold on. Be patient. Please stand by.
Yes. As a Yale man, how do you think George Bush got into and survived Yale without flunking out?
Well, you know, about 6 months after the 2000 campaign, his Yale transcript leaked somehow. And he turns out he had a slightly better grade point average than Al Gore did at Harvard. You know, the notion that he's a blithering idiot is simply not accurate. You can see why people might think that. He's not stupid. I had lunch with his dad Sunday, and for whom my heart breaks because there's no kinder and more decent man than George Herbert Walker Bush. I don't know what happened. There's a movie out all about it, and we were going to see. Too long to explain, but he turned to me at one point during lunch. It was just us. And he said, have you seen the movie? And I had, and I sort of pretended to choke on my jumbo shrimp and said, well, yes, sir, I have. He said, I said, well, you come off very well. I'll tell you do we have time for an anecdote? An anecdote about working for George Herbert Walker Bush. I went down to Washington in 1981, and I was 29. I was still young. I still had my hair was the color of this. I was pumped up and full of sort of self-importance, as you know you tend to be when you're 29 and going down to be chief speechwriter for the Vice President of the United States. There's an Austin Powers flavor to that. $1 million. But it was sort of a big moment in my life. And I imagine that this, you know, my tenure there would change the course of history, and that my speeches would be analyzed in the Kremlin and reprinted in full on the front page of the New York Times. And that, in a word, this was all about me, you know. Well, then I got there, and in about 72 hours, I realized it doesn't really matter what a vice president says. No one cares. We could never get media coverage for his speeches. The only media we could get was the guy from C-SPAN, who would come and set up his camera on a tripod in the back of the room and then go smoke in the lobby. Yeah. Just in case someone shot him, so that... very frustrating. One day in December of 1981, the Cold War heated up. Remember the Cold War? God, don't you miss the Cold War? You know, so much more fun than this one. The Poles declared martial law in Poland, and Russian tank divisions were moving into Poland, and we went from DEFCON 4 to DEFCON 3. Very exciting. Although it was a big deal at the time. And Bush was scheduled to give a speech anyway 2 days later, so they said, well, Bush will give the official administration response to this crisis. And suddenly Bush was red hot, and I thought, wow, great, this is going to be my moment. So I wrote the speech, and being a highly educated Yale man, as you have noted, I went to Bartlett's Familiar Quotations and found a quote from Thucydides that seemed, appropriate to the occasion appropriate, I believe, is the way you would put it. And so Bush is giving the speech, and we have 50 reporters and live TV cameras going, huge audience. I was just thinking, wow, this is like the chariot race scene in Ben-Hur to me. And he's doing fine, this lovely, lovely man. And he gets to the Thucydides line, and something happened. And he said, as the Greek historian he was like a parrot with a piece of banana stuck in his throat. I was sitting at the staff table with Admiral Murphy. Admiral Murphy was the 4-star Navy admiral who was Mr. Bush's chief of staff. And I had been with Benedictine monks for 4 years, and I thought I knew about figures of authority. And then I went to work for a 4-star Navy admiral. And boy, are they strict, you know. And Admiral Murphy was glowering at me. And I was saying, I didn't make up this word, you know. And Bush, poor Mr. Bush, is up there going, ooh, sounding as though he was having an epileptic seizure. And he finally got through it somehow. God smiled and he went, Thucydides. And Admiral Murphy came up afterwards and poked me in the chest with his very naval finger and said, next time say Plato. And that was the beginning of the Platonic era of Bush rhetoric. Anyway, any more questions? Yes, sir, from the back. But wait, wait for the all-important microphone. We must have the microphone. The people must be heard.
Yes, in a February piece in the New York Times, I believe you defended John McCain from his conservative critics. I was wondering, was it the Sarah Palin pick that just set you off so much, or was there somebody else in the campaign that helped you along?
Well, to the extent, it's the what I wrote is very findable on thedailybeast.com, that marvelously named website, named, of course, for the newspaper in Evelyn Waugh's classic satire Scoop, Tina Brown's new website. I'd known John McCain personally since 1982, and he is a fine man. We ought to be very grateful to have such men. John McCain began serving his country at the age of 17, and is now 72. So today, my heart is literally filled with gratitude for John McCain's service. But I had problems with his campaign. I thought he did not run a good campaign, and ultimately one judges the potential of an aspirant president by the kind of campaign they run. And he managed somehow to turn himself, to me anyway, from a very authentic a person, a very real person, into something other than that. And then, indeed, came the Palin announcement. And I, like probably many, initially swooned and thought, gosh, you know, here's a fresh face. But then she began to talk. And, one wants to be gentlemanly about it, but I had great difficulty imagining Governor Palin occupying the Oval Office in the capacity of Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Armed Forces, despite her knowledge of Russia and her command of the Alaskan National Guard, our first defense in the event of an invasion. So, in a way, that was that kind of put me over. But I'm casting this very negatively. It was more a feeling of call it the audacity of hope about Senator Obama, whose books I have read and commend to you. This is a first-rate temperament, as Oliver Wendell Holmes said famously of FDR. And though he has been left-wing in his politics, and I am not, I don't think I sense that is not how he would govern. I think he is. I think he will govern differently. So, it was really more of a pro-Obama sentiment than an anti-McCain. But put the two of them together, and you end up endorsing the Democrat. You know, look, I. Just to add on this note, I mean, in 2000, I voted for the conservative Republican candidate. 8 years later, we have a doubled national deficit, We are in an ill-premised war overseas. We have had ruinous expansion of the entitlement programs. We face in the next 20, 25 years $55 trillion in unfunded liabilities. It's an unimaginable sum. And our banks are being nationalized. Tell me why I shouldn't vote for the Democrat. Because he's a socialist? One more? How are we doing on time? One more. The question on bulk purchases of the books. I believe the limit is 25 books per 50? 50? 50 books is the limit. I'm afraid we must limit it to that.
I grew up reading your father's journal and his novels, and I'm just wondering if your novel writing was at all influenced by his very entertaining spy books.
Not so. No. He wrote 11 spy novels, all of them quite wonderful and very successful and big bestsellers. He became a novelist very improbably at the age of 50. My inspiration or prompting to it was that I was working in the White House, and I was there for 2 years. And while I was there, I became fascinated with these memoirs that people who have worked in the White House write. Anyone who works in the White House for more than a week writes an 800-page memoir, usually with the word power in the title, you know, proximity to power, you know. And so I began reading these, and I became sort of quite fascinated with the genre. And at the end of 2 years, finding myself out of work and needing some gainful employment, I thought to try to write a comic novel in the form of a parody of a White House memoir. And I did, and that it was called The White House Mess, which is a what the French would call a double entendre, because as you may know, the White House is a navy facility. It doesn't exactly float. Sometimes it sinks, but it is administered by the Navy, and the little dining hall, the cafeteria, is called the mess. So it seemed to work, and anyway, so that was how that all started. Life is very accidental. I'll close, you know, with the famous Yiddish proverb: "Want to make God laugh? Tell him your plans." Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.